Hello and welcome to the Spooky Chris Podcast. My name is Chris Ringler. I am the aforementioned Spooky Chris. Welcome. I am honored to be joined today by artist Mark Bloodworth. Mark is renowned for his work in comics, having gotten his start on Night Streets and Dead World for Arrow Comics. Some of the titles he's worked on include Hellraiser, Jack the Ripper, Midnight Mortuary, and many, many others. He is an extraordinarily talented artist who brings a very intricate realism to the scenes he draws, and it's a very visceral look. And I am thrilled to be able to speak to him today, and I hope you will sit back and enjoy. Well, thank you, Mark, for joining me. How are you?
I'm good. How are you, Chris?
I am doing well. I appreciate it. It's actually been a little while since we've spoken, so this is nice to catch up with you.
Yeah.
A little.
Yeah, it has been. It's been a while. Yeah.
I'll just jump right in here. When did you first start drawing?
Oh, when I first started drawing, I was young, probably 7 to 8 years old, maybe.
Okay.
You know, if it was earlier than that, anyone that could tell me or verify that, as long as it was passed on. So I can only go by my earliest memories, which is about 7 years, 8 years old.
Now, what were you, I mean, you know, all kids are kind of drawing different things at that age. What were you drawing back at that age?
Yeah, well, like I said, there's probably things that, I was drawing before, but my main memory would be drawing the Marvel superheroes, because at the time the old 60s cartoon series was on, and I would watch that, and they were like, it was about like a half hour long, and I would just draw the superheroes. And not realizing that these were comic books. So I didn't know that any of these guys were in comic books. I just thought it was cartoons. So I would just draw pictures of Captain America, the Hulk, Iron Man, stuff like that. And it wasn't until I think I was probably 8 or 9. And there was a backyard, like a yard sale or something going on down the block one summer. And I had probably a quarter on me or 50 cents or something like that. And they had, so in the backyard, they have comic book boxes all up on tables and stuff. And I'd never seen comic book boxes before, long boxes, short boxes. So I picked out a comic book, one of the first ones I pulled out, and it was a coverless copy of, Avengers, King Size Avengers number 4. And right there were like everybody that I watched during the week. There was Iron Man and Captain America, Thor, those Giant Man and the Wasp and all that. And I was just like, that was my introduction to comic books, superhero comic books specifically. And the fact that everything that I had been watching was, here are the stories. The story started here. And that issue actually had two of the stories that had actually been turned into cartoons.
Oh, wow.
And that blew me away. So I was just like, well, wait a minute. So then my young mind is doing the math and realizing, it's like, wait a minute, this stuff came out first. Because even this comic book is a reprint, So, and then I was pretty much hooked, because then I realized, Spider-Man was a part of that too, because I was watching the old 60s Spider-Man cartoon. And then, so I started, anytime we were at a drugstore, so I'd go to the spinner rack and I'd find it. I just started picking these things up and slowly started getting hooked on comic books. And then, then Marvel had their monster line, and then I got started, started reading that stuff too, because I was probably a horror fan before I was a superhero comic book fan.
Okay. Well, what was your kind of gateway into liking horror?
Oh, that was my mom.
Same.
My mom,
same.
My mom, yeah, really for you too.
Yeah.
Yeah, my mom was, well, she was first and foremost a movie buff. She loved movies. And but she really did enjoy the horror movies. And again, the classic Universal Monsters. I mean, those were, anytime they were shown, she was gonna watch those. And so Cervantes Gasly, that was a Saturday ritual in our house. Watching Sir Graves Gasly on a Saturday afternoon, rain or shine, it didn't matter. We were like, even if it was nice outside, we didn't. If we were out playing, we came home and watched Sir Graves, and then went back out again. Or if we hadn't been out yet, as soon as Sir Graves was over, there was like they were outside and we were playing. But watching anything that was on there, and then as my brother and I got older, we would like watch The Ghoul. I think he was on Friday nights there, and then a lot of the other stations had things as we were getting into our tweens and teens. It wasn't a horror host per se. It was usually just like it's really late on a Friday night and Channel 7's just trying to fill a couple hours, so they would and Channel 7, for anybody who's listening that doesn't know, Channel 7 was the ABC affiliate and Channel 4 was our NBC affiliate and Channel 2 was our CBS affiliate back then. So they would just play movies, but like Sir Graves always kind of, for the most part, stayed with the classic like shock theater stuff. The Ghoul, it seemed like he always, it was like every other week he was showing Psychomania. That's like my strongest memory of watching The Ghoul. Besides all the hijinks, it's like there were times that my brother and I were just like we knew about the movie Psychomania, which was called the Death Wheelers, I think, everywhere else. And we always laughed about that. It's like, man, didn't it seem like he was always showing that movie? Like, I can't remember any other movie he showed. He had to have shown another movie. But then, like, those are the two horror hosts I remember. I do have a dim memory of hearing about Morgus. But Morgus was in Detroit. Morgus the Magnificent. He was in Detroit before I was like even born, But I remember hearing about that from other people because as soon as you'd have a cousin come over or something, and we had a lot of older cousins, and they would talk about that kind of stuff. And but for us, it was Sir Graves Gasly, and then like I said, Mom. I mean, Mom was the one that would if she was out shopping. She would pick up the big books, the big pictorial histories, like Dennis Gifford's Pictorial History of Horror Movies and Pictorial History of the Westerns and Infamous Murders. I mean, that's where I learned about the Black Dahlia murder and a lot of Jack the Ripper stuff was all through this big hardcover my mom picked up called Infamous Murders. And again, my brother and I are probably like 9 and 10 because he was a year younger than me. So like, and our parents were like, because my dad was like, I need to read, because my dad, just to let people know that like I grew up in the 70s, but our parents had us late. My mom was 35 when she had me and 36 when she had my brother, or 34 and 35, I can't remember. But so, we were, my parents were basically like, and I try to explain this to people that my parents were already the establishment. It's like, my brother and I are growing up at the time of hippies and long hair and all this kind of stuff. And my parents were the establishment. So they, to them, us sitting around watching TV for more than a couple of hours, that was, go out there and play, go do something, So. So my dad was glad, even with the comics, my dad didn't care. It's like he's reading, It's like, and look, now he's drawing, he's doing something, really care about. So mom was the instigator when it came to horror, and we sat there with and I just really ate it up. And my brother ate it up too, but he was still young enough that sometimes he'd get nightmares over things. But I think a lot of that had to do with as he was getting older, he got into learning about special effects makeup and stuff like that. And he like really started to get, he was, so he was the one that would get like the Pressman kits, the Dick Smith Pressman kits,
Oh, wow.
and monkey around with all that kind of stuff, trying to make scars and painting and, you know, doing stuff like that. And I think that was the way he handled the stuff that was, you know, and again, you know, by today's standards, all the stuff we watch was really tame, you know. But back then, you know, this stuff would like keep me awake at night, you know, seeing all this stuff. And so his way of dealing with it was that he learned out how it was done. And again, I think our parents kind of really facilitated stuff like that. You know, it's, you know, like, you know, my mom would say, "Oh my God, he's watching something, he's having nightmares." And my dad would say, "Well, just tell him it's all make believe, you know. It's like, show him how it's done, you know." So anyway, and then my way of coping with anything was drawing. I would just draw.
It's funny that you mentioned Sir Graves so much because that's who I grew up with. I grew up watching Sir Graves and Channel 7, the ABC affiliate, was showing Abbott and Costello every
Yeah,
Sunday,
yeah.
like every Sunday
Sunday
morning.
mornings, yeah. If it wasn't Shirley Temple, it was Abbott
And I'd watch that, and then
Costello.
later on the Chiller double feature on Channel 20, and so.
That's right. I remember that too. That's right.
Because so that, yeah, we had like really, I mean, a golden era in this area before the advent of really even VHS. Just, you know, we had these little niches of classic horror we got to dive into, which was really great.
Yeah, I mean, I was considered myself pretty lucky that I grew up in the area I did grow up in, because in Metro Detroit, I mean, we could get stuff in from Canada as well, you know. And then at some point, by the time I was, what was I, 10, 11? So this would have been like 73, 74. My dad put this big, huge antenna on that you could actually rotate. So we could, on a clear day, we could pick up like, you know, channel 54, you know, some Quebec station or something. It
Oh,
was,
wow.
everything was in French, you know. I mean, it may not have been Quebec, but it was a French station, Canadian French station. And I watched plenty of movies there that I didn't know what was going on, but it was like, hey, you know, it's cool. But yeah, between the horror hosts that we had here, and like you mentioned, you know, Channel 20 doing the chiller, I think Channel 7 had like Scream Theater or something
Okay.
that they showed like by the mid to late 70s, they had something there. And and then picking up, we had good PBS stations here, and then Canadian television too, because between PBS and Canadian television, because Canadian television, they wouldn't, with the exception of maybe commercials, they wouldn't edit stuff.
Oh, wow.
So that was like, you know, if it wasn't PBS, it was a Canadian station where I would watch movies and like, and outside of horror stuff, just saying things like, you know, Help, the Beatles Help, you know, and stuff like that. Things that I would have been, you know, too young to see, but, you know, wanting to actually, you know, watch something like that, because I knew who the Beatles were. Like, it doesn't mean the Beatles have been disbanded by the time I ever figured it out. But to be able to see that stuff and to pretty much see it uncut, you know, that was really wild. Without, because again, trying to see that stuff in the theater, I mean, unless there was some college or some art house going to be showing that stuff, you couldn't see that. Hello, are you there?
Yes, sorry, I thought I lost for a
Okay,
second.
all right. I wasn't sure. At first, I wasn't sure if my earbuds pumped out of me or
Nope.
not. I was like, oh my God, is she talking to me? And I can't hear.
No, you're fine. It's interesting. Yeah, I have a 4-year-old now, so it's interesting, like the era she's growing up in compared to how we grew up. Because yeah, like the antennas, we had one too. There's one on our house now that, you know, they had had. It's so interesting that what you watched was kind of privy to the weather. If you had a big like the dial that you would dial in, or and it would slowly move the antenna to kind of hone in on stuff. And yeah, you could get
Yes.
where, you know, I get a cable and everything, you can see everything under the sun, but
back then it was so interesting because you would see this little area, but like radio, old school radio, you could like if you could had the right weather and you could finesse the dial enough, you could catch stuff that you wouldn't any other time.
Exactly.
And
Yeah,
it's
those were fun times.
yeah, like I mean I heaven knows I prefer to live in an era where I can just kind of dial stuff up easily, but like there was that was an era of discovery that you don't find as easily anymore. So it was really interesting. So
Yeah, you know, and it was kind of fun. The search for that stuff was fun too, because, now, I mean, pretty much everything's gonna at your fingertips,
oh yeah.
but then,
I mean,
yeah, but then.
Lord knows I much prefer being able to just go online and buy these boutique kind of movies. But it was fun looking for the bootlegs, like going to the way old school comic conventions and horror conventions and like trying to find. I remember finding the bootleg of Ricky O that way. So,
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's like the stuff that you would find, or even just see. I have fond memories of old local conventions, the small, I still call them glorified flea markets. But, they'd have a little room off someplace and someone's got like, a complete Star Trek episode,
oh wow, yeah.
unfilmed, like not videotape, unfilmed.
Oh
And
wow.
I'm watching, yeah, that's how I saw Night of the Living Dead. It's like I was probably 13, 12 or 13 years old. Somebody was just showing it in one of these rooms. I just kind of got in there and sat down and started watching it. It just, blew me away. I was like, whoa, what is this? So, but yeah, and then like I said, watching the Star Trek episode Uncut and then realizing that there were scenes that I'd never saw before.
Oh,
Because
wow.
stuff, as this stuff's getting shown in syndication, it keeps getting cut and cut and cut for commercials. They're showing more and more commercials and less of the show. So they're cutting out every possible little bit they can that doesn't detract from the episode. And so there are, certain lines and certain scenes and certain looks. And I'm like, I don't remember ever seeing. I thought I knew these things backwards and forwards,
Wow.
that, and again, that's one of those eye openers that you don't realize that when you're a kid. And then
Yeah.
finally you see something like this and you're like, oh, wait a minute. There's a whole lot else going on here that I don't know about. But yeah, so that's, mom was the instigator with my love of horror and my love of first with the Universal Monsters and then just branching out from all of that, the Hammer horror and then everything that was like 60s and 70s. And I'll let, there was that time like in my tweens and teens that like the grainier the film stock, the more I wanted to watch it, because it meant to me that I shouldn't be watching it. So, and when you're a teenager, that's the thing that matters the most. It's like I probably shouldn't be watching this, which makes me want to watch it even more.
Which is funny because yeah, like you can watch, I mean, even today, watching modern movies that have kind of extremities in them are shocking, but then you see something like Peeping Tom. I don't know if you've ever seen Peeping Tom,
Yes.
which it's, you see that and you're like, oh, this doesn't feel like I should be seeing this. This feels wrong.
Exactly. Exactly.
Cause, and
Exactly.
that's a, what, 69, I think. Like it's far enough back that you're like, whew.
Yep.
You forget how, I mean, they pushed the limits back then even and further back, and we just don't, realize that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of those things that and that's why I said I'm kind of glad that like the romantic part of me that wish I could have been around earlier, but I really do think I was born at the right time and I lived through a really good time period where I had Boris Karloff and James Whale, but I also had Wes Craven and Michael Berryman. It's like I grew up in this perfect time of all this, at the time modern horror, which was like I said, a lot of it was stuff that like you felt like you should be watching, which just made it that much more scary. And all
Yep.
this classical stuff,
It definitely felt a lot more dangerous.
Yeah,
Like
it
you
did.
couldn't
That was.
trust the filmmakers behind, like, like, especially you look at something like Texas Chainsaw Massacre, and like you don't know if you can trust the people making this movie. It's like, should I be seeing this?
Exactly. Should I be watching this? I'm not sure I should be watching. It's like, did I really see what I thought I was seeing?
Now
And again,
you
and the other thing about watching that stuff, even like if you're watching it on TV and you're staying up really late one night, you're catching this stuff on some station, or you happen to be able to go catch it in the theater, it's like it's not like you're watching it over and over and over again. Like what you see, or what you think you see, is what you saw,
yeah.
and it sticks with you. And now you can go, you can search something back and watch it again, and it kind of kills the moment. It kind of like explodes the time. It's like there's something sad about that in a certain way. But anyway,
No,
that's all that.
I absolutely get what you're saying though. Like, you're right. So you've done a lot of work kind of in horror and with horrific images and stuff. What since, after your mom kind of introduced you to scary stuff, what really kept bringing you back to horror?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think it was just I just liked the monsters at first, because again, I mean, I'm a visual artist. I work mostly with line. I mean, as a child, mostly with pencils and crayons and stuff, and then as I got older, I started using pens and brushes, things like that. And I paint. It's not that I don't. I use acrylics and gouache and stuff like that. It's not that I don't do color work and paint, but I like doing a lot of line work and drawing. But I think the monsters, just because, like I said, I'm an artist, I'm trying to capture these things, so I'm more visually attuned, and my acuity is more visual than anything else. It's how I learn too. I'll learn more visually than I will hearing something or reading it. But then again, movies, documentaries, that combines all that stuff. And I can learn a lot of stuff really quickly that way than if I'm sitting down just looking at a book or something. But I think it was just the visual nature of them, as well as, like I said earlier, with the superheroes. And then just drawing it, and then realizing that I really wasn't that bad at drawing. So it's like that, and that's the thing I think everybody wants to find at a young age. Like, what's this thing that I'm good at? What is it that I can do? And I was pretty lucky in that respect, that I kind of knew from an early age that no matter what, when it was time to, quote unquote, grow up and get a job or something, I knew that I wanted to do something within the art world. Whether it was commercial art, whether it was fine art, whether, no matter what it was. And so the monsters themselves, I think, is what really brought me into that. And then as I'm getting older, getting into my teenage years and wanting to create my own stuff, and then meeting other people too, because you meet that friend that fancies themselves a lighter, so now they got a story and they want you to draw pictures for them. And so then I start delving more into storytelling and starting to pay attention to that. And then that dovetails back into my love of comics. So now it's, I want to do comics. So now, because to me it's like, I'm probably never going to do the movies. And let's face it, trying to make a movie, and this is the stuff my brother was doing. My brother was the one that, like, asked for a camera and save up money for film. And I saw like what it's taking him to try to do something, whereas I'm like, give me some paper and a pencil and I'm good to go. So I don't have to worry about, paying for getting the film and the paying to get it developed and hoping that things turn out. But so that way I could just do storytelling, because I think I would say at least sometime by junior high, early high school, I realized that I'd like to be a storyteller, And I did a lot of prose stuff when I was in, because a lot of times you're just basically writing stuff or reports and then creative writing assignments and things like that. But I just love doing comics. And, you know, in the beginning, you know, you're with your friends and you're doing basically your own rip-off superhero characters. And but then you had those couple of friends that dug the monsters like you did, and then they would come up with ideas and then you draw them and stuff like that. And I think part of it was, I don't know, I think there's something about horror that you can tell a story and you can add the subtext to it. So, you know, it, on the surface, it can be about a vampire, but the subtext is like not really about a quote unquote vampire. It's about something else. You know, like Clive Barker said, you know, the whole Hellraiser thing, it's all about addiction. You know, it's like, on the one hand, you can look at it as, oh, there's these demons and they're coming and they're grabbing these people. But the subtext is, this is about addiction and how it's going to tear you and your family apart.
Yeah.
And all your loved ones are going to suffer because of this thing that you just can't stop and you need to get help for. So, and I think that's probably why I gravitated towards horror per se, as opposed to, I mean, just, you know, I mean, there was a time I wanted to work for Marvel and draw Spider-Man, you know, because Spider-Man was one of my favorite characters growing up. But by the time I was able to get a Marvel contract, I was doing Hellraiser. So it was like, you know, and by, you know, and again, by the time I've got my foot in the door and can probably start moving through and doing things, the last thing on my mind would be to do Spider-Man, because quite frankly, I no longer cared about that sort of thing. And to be frank, I didn't even recognize the character anymore. It's like, I didn't even know what my Spider-Man was. I think they left my Spider-Man in the dust, you know? So it's just like, you know, I'll go with work with these monsters and just go do something else. So, which is funny though, because one of the first published comic books that I did that I actually made any money off of with Arrow Comics back in 85, 86, 87, 88, was a book called Night Streets, which at its heart had a costume vigilante.
Oh, okay.
But yeah. And so, but at the same time, it was sprung forth from an earlier character that was a 7 foot tall bipedal talking cat. You know? So, and he was the you know, the mob boss of the city, you know, one of the top mob bosses, you know. He was like the Michael Corleone, you know, of the story. And But it still had this, you know, so it had this fantastical, horrifying element, but still it had the trappings of a superhero running around, even though she had no superpower. She was more like Batman, you know, Batgirl and the Huntress in that respect. But I just thought it was funny that instead of being a straight on horror book, it kind of blended the two, you know, whereas my peer at the time, my colleague, Ben Slock, you know, he was the one that did Deadpool, the zombie book that Arrow was doing. And so I just think it's funny. But yeah, so, but then after Night Streets and all that, and then you know, the Marvel gig doing Hellraiser, and then after that, I pretty much stuck with, well, then I started working on Deadpool events. And so then from that point on, I would say it's been horror in what, whether it was true crime, horror, or, you know, more supernatural horror. It's been horror ever since then.
Now, I was going to ask.
If I actually answered your question or not.
No.
That was
perfect. It was perfect. And it segues. I was going to ask you what it was like working on Dead World. That was one of my favorite comics, like as a teen, late teen.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, I've heard that a lot too from other people that I've met that. They come up to me and they were teenagers reading that stuff when we were doing it, and they really enjoyed it. And they remember that we were around before a certain other zombie ongoing series that I won't mention.
Yep.
And so I wound up working on that because I finished up Night Street, the first storyline. And again, you know, we were all going to be doing our own books. And, there was a point in time that, like, I would have kept Night Streets going. But the market changed, things were blowing up. And again, that's a whole other, we could do a whole other episode on the whole black and white implosion and all that stuff. But a lot of us were just kind of left out there, and Arrow folded because they were owed a lot of money that they were never going to see, and they could not afford to keep going. So Stu and Ralph, they gave us the properties that we were working
Oh, wow.
on, free and clear. You know, they were all creator-owned books. So like I, for the most part, already owned Night Streets. But there was still a deal with them as a publisher where they got 50%, and we split all of that stuff. But like Guy Davis, who worked on The Realm, he was the artist, so he got a percentage. So he had a percentage of ownership of it. But Ralph and Stu were the ones that actually created the book. But you know, but they brought him in as well. So he was like that like 30% part of creator. You know, well, in whatever percentage they did actually, divvy it up. And the same thing with Vince on Dead World. You know, it was, Ralph's idea. Stu did the scripting, but if you don't have Vince's visuals, it really doesn't mean anything. So the three of them are Dead World. So, like I said, so everything's falling apart. So they just made sure that we all had our all had contracts that basically put all this stuff in our hands, and it's like, Vince, from that point on, owned Deadpool. It was his property to do with whatever he wanted to do. Guy, free and clear, owned the realm. He could do whatever he wanted to do with that. And I, free and clear, owned everything in Night Streets, and I could do whatever I wanted So then we're talking like 88 into 89. And so now Gary Reed, who owned two or three comic book shops in the metro area. And we'd known him. He had originally started doing the King Con in 85. I think he did one in 86, but I can't remember. I think he only did one or two of those. And then stopped doing those because I think that's when he started really going into the comic book business, having stores and stuff. So now he taught, I think he taught biology at one of the colleges, and he, like I said, he was an entrepreneur and he's a businessman. He owned these stores. He wanted to get into publishing. So, because enough dust had settled with all the implosion that he felt he could make a go of it, and because again, a lot of what any competition there would have been, everything's just fallen by the wayside. So he put the word out and let us know, and a lot of the other metro area artists like Alan Oldham and Dirk Johnston, and of course James LaBarre, and let us know that he wanted to get a company together and put some books out. And he basically told, I mean, I know he told this to me, and I can only assume that he told the guy at Vince as well, that whatever you guys want to do, I'll publish it. Whether you want to work on Night Streets or Dead World or whatever, I'll publish it. So, and that was, and like I said, he said it to me. I'm just assuming that he said it to the others as well. Because, and I don't see why he wouldn't, because he did publish just about everything he did. But, and again, I always joke that I think he liked Night Streets more than I did at that point. Like he wanted to read more of it, So, but I was kind of burned out because I was doing the writing, and I was doing the penciling, and I was doing the inking, I was doing and the covers, and I was doing everything but like lettering it, and then doing the production on it, And I can guarantee you though, had I had the setup, I probably would have been doing all that too. Like if I'd had a stat camera and everything, I probably would have been doing that. So anyway, so Gary starts up Caliber, and we're all together and we're doing this. So now the one thing I'm doing there is finishing up Night Streets. So I tell Gary, I probably got about 60 more pages I got to do, and I can finish up the storyline. So it would have been probably the equivalent of maybe 7 issues. Only 5 issues came out from Arrow. So maybe there's like about 2 issues left, and that first storyline would be done. So how about I wrap that up, and then we'll see what's coming, instead of me jumping on anything right away, So he says, okay, go ahead and do that. So Vince is working on Deadpool. So this is like 89 into 90. So by the time 1990 rolls around, I'd say by maybe the middle of 1990, possibly the fall, my stuff is all done as far as Nightstreams. So he repackages the first 4 issues as Nightstreams, Mob Rules Book One, and then he takes issue 5 and then all the new work that I did and makes Nightstreams, Mob Rules Book Two. And that comes out like a couple of months afterwards, sometime in the like spring or summer of 1990. And so now that's done. So now I'm just doing little random commission pieces here and there in conventions, sitting at the table and stuff like that. And Vince is starting to get to that point where he's getting burned out on Deadpool, the same way I got burned out on Nightstreams, because at this point, Gary's coming up sometimes with the plots, and maybe Vince is coming up with the plots, but then Vince is also doing the pencils and the inks and doing the lettering, because Vince is a phenomenal letterer. And so he's doing the lettering as well. So he's doing a lot of work. And sometimes he's maybe scripting, some most of the time Gary's scripting, but still, he's still got to write all this stuff down regardless because he's the letterer. So he's starting to get burned out. So I find out about this, and I can't remember if I find out because it just got brought up in one of the meetings. Because we would get together, I don't think it was once a week, maybe once a month, or maybe every couple of weeks. Because like in the old Arrow days, we got together just about every week, it seemed, every Friday. And with Caliber, it was more like you could drop in whenever you wanted to, but it seemed like getting everybody there was easily once a month, maybe twice a month. And but anyway, whether one of them reached out to me or it was just brought up in a meeting, it was like, what would you think about, Pencil Deadworld? And I'm thinking, yeah, I could do that, I could pencil it because to me, and I think it was probably more or less Gary's idea. I think Gary probably just figured out, Vince, what would you like to do? You want to do the breakdowns and the pencils, and you want to do the inks? And Vince probably said, I'd rather do the inks, So, and then asked me, it's like, hey, would you do the pencils? And I said, sure. So then that's how I started working on Deadpool. So that way Vince didn't have to do so much work on it and give him a little bit more free time. And again, a little bit, you'd have to talk to Vince about that, but it was probably maybe like 10% more free time. So he could work on other projects. And some of those projects were stuff that was in Deadpool because there was some backup stories that he was doing where he was doing the writing and the penciling and the inking, but it wasn't in the main continuity. It was like periphery stuff, little explorations of things that he could do, and play with the storytelling artwork now that he really felt in, felt like he was really grasping it and doing it. And a little side note, he didn't think he could do comics. He just figured that he was just an artist and illustrator back in the Arrow days. And yeah, and again, you'll probably have to talk to him or Guy about this, but I distinctly remember, and I think Guy backed me up on this one, that we basically had to like strong arm Vince to actually do Dead World. Like he didn't think he could do it. He didn't think his style was right. He didn't think he could do a sequential storytelling. He didn't do any of that. And then, I mean, history, speak for itself as to where he's gone to now. So but anyway, so he wanted to do more experimenting with that kind of stuff. And then I think eventually start to move away from it because during all of this, while I held on to Nightstreams, because I was working, and it's the other thing you have to understand, like I'm a little older than these guys. So I'm freelancing and working at like, different typesetting houses and stuff like that. And then I got a bigger corporate job So, but they both, he and Guy, I mean, they're, you know, and they're still going to school too, meaning college and things like that. So they're trying to, like, you know, pay the bills. So they eventually sell the properties to Gary. So now Vince is working at a book that he really doesn't have any vested interest in, you know. So that's why he kind of starts to move away from it. So initially, I'm doing the pencils and the breakdowns. He's doing the finishes and the lettering. And then slowly, after he gets done with some backup stories, then he's done with it and he wants to kind of move on. And so then I start taking over for a few issues, doing, I finished up some of the plots that Gary had, but then I start writing and penciling and inking. And now I find myself, I'm right back where I started. What am I doing? You know, so Vince is lettering it. And the reason Vince is lettering it still is because not only does it keep it cohesive, because it still looks the same, anybody that picks it up, they see Vince lettering. But lettering paid, you know, because, you know, the pencilers and the inkers and the writers, you know, we're getting royalty deals. We're not getting flat page rates. But if you're a letterer or work in production, you're getting flat page rate. You're getting paid, you know, if you're working in the office production, that's an hourly rate. And if you're doing, you know, the lettering, where you're getting a flat fee for each page. So that's money that he's got in his hand. So he's still doing the lettering, but he's not doing anything else. I think a random cover here. But so then, like I said, so now I've painted myself back into the same corner. But now I'm working on the book that, just like with Vince, it's like, well, I don't have any stake in Deadworld, you know? So it's like, I might still keep doing it. It's fun, but man, I got to start thinking about something else because I'm already working a day job. So I'm working two jobs, basically. You know, I'm working a 9 to 5 job, even though it was more like a, you know, 7 in the morning to 3 in the afternoon job. And then I'm putting in another 6 to 8 hours every evening working on comics.
Wow.
So I had written a whole bunch of storyline out. So I did, I think the last artwork I did was, I think, issue 18. I think that was the last time you saw any of my artwork in Deadpool. But the storylines that I wrote kept going on to, like, issue 23, I think, at least 23, maybe 25. But I think I could say take up to issue 23. But by then, the Day Brothers, Dan and David Day, were working on the art chores that. So, and they were brothers of the late Gene Day, the inker that, if there's any comic book people out there, he did Master Kung Fu, Shang Chi, Master Kung Fu, and amongst others. But so yeah, so then it was a combination of me realizing that now I'm working, doing all this work on a book that I have no. If I'm going to do all this kind of work, why don't I just do night shift? Because at least I get the money from that. But also, this is now the time period. Getting towards the end of 1990 into 1991, and we're at one of the early Motor City Comic Cons, still held in Dearborn at the Dearborn Civic Center. And Vince and I are sitting next to each other at the Caliber table, and I think Guy was there. I mean, some of the other Caliber people. But this was at a time period where Marvel and DC would still send writers and editors out to conventions, and they would be set up there as well. And one of the editors from, or one of the, I can't remember, writer or editor, he may have been both at the time. But I think what I'm trying to remember, maybe in Nicienza, I think. Nicienza, I think. He came over to the table and saw all the Dead Worlds, and I had my Night Streets out, and the Dead Worlds I worked on, and Vince had all of his Dead Worlds. And he came over, and he's just looking at our stuff, and he's thumbing through it, and he's like, why aren't you guys working on Hellraiser? And we just looked at him and was like, yeah, I don't know. You tell us. Why aren't we working on Hellraiser? Right? And he's like, oh, all right. Well, hey, write your contact info down. I can't remember if we gave him a piece of paper. We just gave him a comic and wrote stuff down there to give us his info. And I didn't think anything of it, but other than just like, hey, finally, somebody, hey, take notice, huh? A little something for the effort. And but then I would say probably maybe a month or two after that, I got a phone call from him, and he got me in touch with the editor, Mark, I think it was Mark McLaren, of Hellraiser, and then I started working on that. So then that's another reason why I left Dead World, is because for now, I got some paying gigs coming in. So I've already got my day job. Plus now, if I were to spend time staying up till midnight, it's because I'm going to be working on this. It's like I can vouch for this. I can vouch for this stuff and actually get paid in like, 30 days. So, as opposed to I can work on Dead World, but until it starts to get past the break-even point, I'm not seeing it. So, and it's a lot of work. So anyway, so that's in a nutshell how that started with Dead World, like me starting on Dead World and then me leaving Dead World. And this is part of like Gary used to always complain, because after I left, he got a really great artist. I think there may have been some people in between that, but I mean, the Day Brothers were there, but then even the Day Brothers, they were getting swamped because they were drawing just about everything in Dead, as opposed to just the main continuity. They were drawing everything. So then, for the main continuity and stuff, he finds this, I think he's Croatian. I mean, I not was, but he probably still is. I don't think he died. Dalibor Telagic. Dalibor Telagic. And so, and this may have been like more mid-90s to late-90s, I think he came on. And this guy was great. I loved his stuff. Like, if I could have, paid this guy a rate, I'd have had him start drawing night scenes, and I would just write it, But he no sooner gets a couple issues of Dead World under his belt, and Marvel and DC start, or one of the other companies, it would have been Marvel and DC, they tap him on the shoulder too. And this was like Gary's, I think, to his last days, he was just like, every time I get an artist on Dead World, within a month or two, I might get three issues out of them, and then somebody comes along and snaps. To which I would tell him, you should have paid better. That's simple, Gary. You should have paid us better. A little something for the effort. But anyway, where do you want to go next?
One of the questions I was going to ask is just how you've seen the industry change since you started in it.
Well, I think that for a lot of the changes that I think may have been detrimental, there's been a lot of changes I think helped a lot. Crowdfunding has helped. I think that when I was younger, and by younger, I mean in my 20s, when we were doing Arrow over there, working on all this stuff. Guy Davis, he was the one that was really into anime, a lot of the Japanese stuff. Not so much the manga per se, I think that came a little later, but definitely the anime. And a lot of all of that influence that came in, like to me it was, something that's like, I really don't get it. To me, it all looked the same. But then again, I wasn't seeing the whole picture of it. I only saw what was able to make it over to these shores, which was usually all the big eye stuff, the big watery eyes. So, but I think that coming in, which I was pretty blind to, I was even in, my late 20s, I was like the old man saying, "Kids, get off my lawn." But I think that helped because it opened up the doors to anyone in America that you can really make comics about anything you want in And I think that was something that got lost, because it's not that American comics didn't do that. It's just that they weren't doing it anymore. Everything was strictly superheroes, because all you really had was Marvel and DC. That's the whole reason Arrow started up and all the other Black and White independents started up. It wasn't just because Eastman and Laird proved to us that it's like, dude, if you've got about 3 to 5 grand, you can make your own comic. You can get it out there. You know, that's what put the light bulbs over Stu Kerr and Ralph Griffiths' heads. They realized, oh, we can be publishers. We can make our own comics. You know, so it wasn't just like getting your own thing out there, but it's like, but you don't need to be limited by this. And the reason that we were doing that stuff, the reason why Arrow, the last book Arrow did before they even folded, was a superhero book. That was the last thing on it. We wanted to do everything but superheroes. So, but not realizing that just about everywhere else in the world, that's what they did with comics. If you went to Japan, you could find a comic about baseball. You know, people just playing baseball, people cooking. People, you know, it's like whatever there was, whatever the thing is that humans do, there's a comic book story going on about it. So I think in a certain extent that really kind of helped everything as that breaks through. And as the big two and a lot of the other companies that actually survived, while they're just going to license properties and then holding on to like Marvel and DC, just doing the superhero thing, branching out once in a while with other things, but that stuff doesn't really pay as well as those, you know, longtime heroes and stuff. But I think a lot of that breaking through, that as that stuff starts to become too muddied up with continuity, and there's no easy way to break into it. Like as a reader, there's no easy way to break into that stuff without like reading, you know, 20 years worth of continuity. The fact that this other stuff is coming in and it's being made more accessible by a lot of other companies. Not that Marvel and DC didn't try to do their due diligence, but you've got like Viz and Dark Horse. We're bringing a lot of the manga in and all these other artists and these other storylines and stuff. That sort of opens up that market. And so to me, that's one of the good things that has happened. I think one of the sad things that I've seen happen is that a lot of like the superhero stuff, you know, I don't understand why they're writing stuff for like my demographic, which is, for anyone that doesn't know, I'm 62 years old. I'm just an old white guy. And it's like, it seems like most of the stuff on the stand, for a time period, maybe it's not that much anymore, because, you know, in full disclosure, I haven't really read a superhero comic in probably 40 years. Easily 30 years for sure, but probably 40 years. Because after a while, I just got tired of it. I just wanted to read other stuff. So, but I think that they were just catering too much to my generation, my demographic. Like, you know, I started reading it like, you know, maybe like, let's say 1973, right, when I'm 10 years old. It's like they're still writing for that same person, only now they realize that that person is a 50, 60-year-old man, so they're trying to update these stories and try to make them relevant to somebody like that, which is how you get into the whole thing of all this quote-unquote realism and stuff like that. It's like, I'm sorry, but Superman should be for kids. Batman should be for kids. There's no, I mean, I'm not saying it's got to be silly, but they should be basically just done in one stories that you don't need, you know, you can just pick up an issue and read it. You know, I think a lot of that heavy continuity and all these big soap opera storylines really kind of kill a lot of that stuff, because you can branch out from there. That, to me, it's like that stuff should just be like the gateway drug to get people hooked on comics. So I think that's one of the things that I don't think worked very well, and maybe they're trying to get away from it. I'm not sure. But some of the things that I think have helped a lot is the technology that's come in, so that just about anybody can do their own comics. You know, You don't even have to get out of bed if you don't want to. You know, I mean, granted, you have to have a certain level of income because, you know, in order to access the technology or use the technology, but, you know, by the same token, you can just have nothing but a pencil and paper in front of you and start doing your own comic and go down to the local FedEx Kinko's and run that stuff off on a copier and make your own comics. But you also have access to getting onto the internet and putting that stuff out there too and reaching a huge audience, much more huge than we ever could have thought back when we were doing it 40 years ago. You know, I can do something today and put it on the internet, and it's just going to go out there. And depending on how big my net is now, and all my followers and friends, how much farther they can send it out there, get that blast out there. More people are going to see that stuff than anybody would have seen anything I did before. So I think in that respect, for anybody coming into this new, the just being able to get online and put that stuff out there, and with the crowdfunding sources there are to actually be able to put a book together and get it printed and shipped out to people that you know want to see it because they put in the money to help you get it done. You know, whereas before we were working basically in the dark. It was almost like making a movie in the respect of if you're in the theater and you're putting out a play, the audience is right there, and you know whether that play is working or not. When you're making a movie, you're secluded. You don't see anybody but the people that are all involved in it, and you're all just trying to help each other get through it, and you don't know whether this thing's good or bad until it gets out there. And by then, it's too late because now it's out there. So, but now, the way things are, that you can get something together, put it together, put it out there, and you can pretty good idea right off the bat whether it's something that is hitting somewhere or not. And again, you put something up on, you know, Zoop or Indiegogo or Kickstarter or anything like that, so any crowdfunding platform, and you get it out there, you'll know pretty sure if people are digging what you're putting out there or not, whether you've got, you know, whether you meet your quota or not, and also how many backers you're going to get. It gives you an idea of what its reach is going to be, you know. Because a lot of people, I'll tell people, it's like, you know, if you want to get into doing comics and do this stuff because you want to be a millionaire, stop. Just go work in a bank. Go get in finance if you want to be a millionaire. You know, it's like, you got to be willing to lose money. You got to be willing to put in a lot of long hours with very little return. You got to be willing to, you just want to do this because you're going to do it. And then you'll always be happy with it because there's no guarantee in any of this stuff. I mean, it may hit, it may take off, but don't, you know, don't put all your hopes and dreams into that, you know. And again, what is it you're getting into? Why are you trying to do this? So, but I think I kind of went off track with what you actually asked, but I would say that the technology we have, the internet, the crowdfunding, I think those are the things that I wish we had had back then, because I think when the first company folded, I think it would have been easier to keep going on than, because again, we were guys walking around with properties, but unless we had a publisher, it didn't matter. You know, we could have been working on that stuff the whole time. You know, I could have done five more volumes of Night Streets, but if I didn't have anybody that would be willing to publish it, didn't matter. You know, because there was really no way for me to get it out there other than stapling the things together myself and then just hoping that somebody walks by that wants to see it, because I got no way of getting it any farther than the convention table I'm sitting at. But now, anybody can just put something out there and get some sort of response. And I think that's a good thing. I mean, a really good thing. And like I said, I think a lot of the detriment is, I think the big two, and I only say this because anytime I go into a comic book store and I look at the shelves and I see anything that's Marvel or DC, it is just their same IPs, and I don't think anything's changed. And I don't see why they don't, like, use the five Spider-Man titles they got, or over at DC, the 20 Batman titles they've got that they know are selling. We'll use that to fund something different. and get that out there. But again, they may be doing that, and I just haven't seen it. I don't know. But I do think a lot of that part of that responsibility is the fans, because
I was gonna say, like, I would wonder if some of it's the fans holding them hostage.
and I think to a certain extent it is, because I can guarantee you when that Superman movie comes out, which looks like a lot of fun to me, it's like probably the first Superman movie I've been looking forward to actually seeing in a long time. I can guarantee you there's going to be people bitching about it.
Oh yeah. Yep.
You know what I'm saying? Like, they will stand in line overnight and pay a ridiculous amount of money to be the first ones in the fucking theater. I'm sorry, that's probably the first time I swore today, and
That's okay.
I don't know if you need to beep that out or not.
No, no, no. Bye.
But they, and then they will do nothing but hammer on it because A didn't happen or B didn't happen, or I can't believe they did. It's like, dude, come on. They had me at crypto. That's all I knew. It's like, because I'm sorry, like, because if you're gonna do something like that, you gotta go all in. It's wacky, it's kooky, it's zany. Let it be. It's supposed to be fantastic. It's a superhero. The guy shoots laser beams out of his eye. Come on. So I do think the fans, to a certain extent, because and I've mentioned this to my sweetie, Claudine, of Claudine Creates. Just go look around Facebook and Instagram, Claudine Creates. But I have pointed stuff out to her as we've been out and about at conventions or in stores. And I'll, like, we're looking through bins and boxes, and I'll pull something out. And I'll say, oh, yeah, you see this? Let's see, there's this guy. Remember that artist we're talking about? Yeah, here's. She's like, oh, wow. And she's new to a lot of this stuff with the comics and all that. So she's like, oh, wow. I said, yeah, we'll pick some stuff up just the Sunday. We're at Ogoni Show. And I'm like, here's the problem. You got somebody who is a fan favorite artist, and everybody loves their stuff. And then they go out and they do something. Like, you got someone like Kyle Baker, right? And he's working on, I think he worked on Captain America, and he worked on some other titles for Marvel and some stuff for DC. And everybody likes that. Art Adams, right? And Mike Hoffman, and all these other guys. And it's like, and then they go and they do something on their own because they think, hey, I got this fan base, right? So, and then, they do their property, their idea, their thing, and nobody picks it up. And it's like, well, where are all you people? Like, because they're not doing Wolverine, you're not going to buy it. It's like, you gotta, it's like, if you like these people's work, you've got to support it. That means when they put their own thing up, you gotta buy that too. But it's like, so I think that's one of the biggest problems when it comes to the fan base. And it's not all fans. I mean, there are fans that will just buy whatever, if they like an artist or a writer, they will be there for no matter what. But I think the majority of the fans, they just like what they know. And they don't want to go anywhere else. And if it's nothing like, well, I don't want to read a biography about somebody. It's like, well, what, you afraid you're going to learn something? It should at least be, trust me, you'll be entertained. The art's going to be beautiful. At the very least, buy it because you like the artist. Yeah, I do think that there's a certain segment of the fan base that just, I don't think they really want to move on or do anything other than to get their monthly dose of Batman. And it's just like, I like Batman too, but at some point you got to say, maybe I want something else too. It's like, there's nothing wrong with a Big Mac, but maybe go get a different burger next time, go someplace else. It's like, or just, or eat a steak. If you like, if you like beef, go eat a steak. Go like a chop house, go someplace. But no, there's some people that will just eat McDonald's their entire life and just never want to deviate from that. So I don't know. So, and now I'm just sounding like exactly what I am, Snow White guy.
No, because I think that's an absolutely fair assessment, because that's kinder than I would maybe even be, is I think there's a large swath of the fan base that their passion is that hatred, that like that's where it used to be kind of like the, even if you didn't like superhero comics or whatever was out there, like, you loved something, and now I think it's the love of hating for some of these
Yeah.
things, and it's just
And
like
you
that's
know, and maybe part of that is them fighting the fact that they hate themselves for still going to it. Like they can't move away from it. And deep down inside, subconsciously, they hate themselves for it, but they can't point the finger at themselves, so they point the finger at the thing that they used to love, but now they don't love it anymore. It's your fault thing that I fell in love with, you know. And it's like, no, maybe you're just beyond this now. And maybe you got to let go. Just let it be somebody else's now.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the way I look at it. It's like, you know, it's like people know that I like Star Trek, right? And they'll say, oh, hey, did you watch Discovery? Did you watch Strange New Worlds? Did you watch Picard? I'm like, no, I got my Star Trek. I'm good. I got the first run. I got the Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. I'm good. I don't need, this is somebody else's Star Trek. Let them have fun with it. What do you want me to do? Go in there and say, I think it sucks? You know, like, what do you want me to do? It's, no, it's got no, I don't, I've moved on. I'm going to go do something else. You know, I'm going to go watch something. I mean, that doesn't mean I just still don't watch the old stuff. You know, like it's showing on like a loop, I think, of Heroes and Icons, you know, but it's like, I'm not going to really run out and watch all this stuff because it's like, well, this stuff is being done for another generation. They're trying to move it on with things. You know, to me, it's like, as long as they're keeping the spirit of what the thing is about, that's all that matters. You know, but all the trimmings of it, it's going to have to change if you're going to keep this thing going, no matter what it is, whether it's Batman, Superman, Star Trek, Star Wars. At some point, it's got to evolve just by virtue of the audience is going to be changing. But the problem is, I think there's too much of that fan base that, like, they were there at the beginning, and by God, I want the same thing I had when I was 14.
Yep.
You know, and it's like, you're not 14 anymore. You got to let it go. Trust me, if you actually went back with adult eyes and looked at that thing, you'd say to yourself, I can't believe I like this so much. It's kind of stupid in a way. You know, and it's like, yeah, it is, because it was supposed to be. You know, you're the one that took it seriously, you know. So, I mean, and I'll use Star Wars as a subject because, like I said, like Star Trek is my jam because I was a kid when that was on and all that stuff. I was 14 years old when Star Wars came out. So I enjoy Star Wars, but I wasn't 5, 6, or 7 years old the first time I saw it, you know. So to me, I'm looking at it with different eyes, you know. Plus the fact that I got my father, who was basically the kid that saw the old Flash Gordon serials in the theater, you know. So he saw it and he knew what it was. He knew where it came from, right? I'm thinking, wow, this is cool because the effects are blowing me away, you know. But again, so he's looking at it from an even farther back perspective. He's like, oh my God, I can't believe, really? They're making movies of this stuff again? Really? You know? So, but again, but that, but there's a certain generation, like, they don't know anything different than that. You know? And sometimes when I meet these people, I have to remind them, it's like, do you know the biggest science fiction film that came out before Star Wars? It was Logan's Run. That was an A-list major studio science fiction release. Logan's Run, the year before Star Wars came out. Logan's Run was the thing. That was the height of science fiction. If you don't count something like, you know, from back in 1969 or 70 with 2001 Space Odyssey. You know, like, but Logan's Run, that was the big adventure. You know, and that big adventure was, hey, I'm about to turn 30, I better get out of here. That's
Yep.
what it was. You know, I mean, sure. Everybody walked around with pajamas, with hot chicks all over the place. People would just have sex wantonly. They could do whatever they wanted. But of course, you know, when you turn 30, you gotta die. So on the surface, it sounds like a good idea, but then it's like, whoa, oh, geez, I'm 29. This isn't so much fun anymore. But again, but it's like, we're not trying to take down the Galactic Empire. It's like, literally, I'm gonna turn old and I've got to get out of here now. So bye. But again, it's like you try to put that in perspective and say, it's like, this is what science fiction was. So like, I get it. It's like it blew things open. But again, but you were a kid when you saw it. I was a kid. I was 14, but things need to move on. They need to go find some other things. And I think that's part of the problem, that nobody, I shouldn't say nobody, but this is a major portion of the fan base that doesn't want to move on. And it even, I know this even happens in the horror fans too. There's a lot of stuff out there that I just sit there and I roll my eyes. It's like, really? You're going to go watch another Halloween movie? Really? Really? What do you think's gonna happen? It's like, or something that new that comes along, but it's not really that new. It's just they kind of dress it up a little differently. And I'm like, okay, and I'm gonna go to the show notes. I haven't seen any of this, so again, this interview will probably come back in a month. But I saw some previews or commercials for the latest Alien thing. The show they're doing, Alien
Oh,
Earth,
yeah.
right? And I'm watching this thing unfold, and it looks pretty interesting. But what I'm thinking is, it's like, okay, I thought the whole point of all this was to try to keep these fuckers from getting on Earth. But more importantly, this has all the earmarks of somebody had this great script for a science fiction movie dealing with, a corporation going out there and harvesting extraterrestrial life forms of all shapes and sizes. Doesn't matter what it is. And this stuff harkens back to, like, Michael Crichton did it with the Andromeda Strain, the whole Project Scoop, going out there and trying to find stuff out in space to see if you can weaponize it and stuff like that. So this has got a long history in science fiction, so nothing new. But it looked like somebody had a script where it's like, let's go, this thing where, like, it's like the Andromeda Strain only to the nth degree, where there are life forms. So we're gonna have an invasive species on the planet. It's not just like, oh, this came from Japan and now it's eating my shrubs. It's like, no, this thing came from some unknown asteroid that got picked up by this drone ship, and now it's loose on Earth. And we don't know what this thing's going to do. We have no way to even study the damn. And I'm thinking, somebody had a script like that, and everybody kept passing on it. And then finally, somebody at Disney said, if we just stamp Alien on, we can green light it. Because we need something new for you. And it's just like, and I guess the point I'm trying to make to this is, it's this twofold thing of, you probably could have had something new and different and spawn a whole new story. A whole new legend of stuff. Or you can stamp a known IP on it. Now people will line up to buy the service to watch it. And you can further dilute what that first movie did back in 1979. And I don't understand, other than the money that's involved, of let's sell them old rope because they seem to like it. It's like, I don't understand why they can't just put their faith and money behind something new, because the only reason you got that Alien franchise is because back in 1977 or 78 or whatever, somebody ponied up the money and said, this script sounds crazy. I don't know how you're going to do it. This director, he's untried. I don't know how this is going to work. Why are there strobe lights everywhere? Where's all this goop coming from? So one of the actresses will take her clothes off at some point. Okay. And they got the money, and they made, like, I can't express to somebody who wasn't there what that movie did to people back in 1979, when you first saw not only that face start to come out, but then watch John Hurt start choking on his space crunchies. And all of a sudden, that thing comes out of his chest. I mean, there were people that were just like losing it in that theater. Now, I mean, who hasn't seen it? Who doesn't just see, it's like people are just waiting for it to happen the next time. They keep wanting to go back to it because they're hoping they're going to get that reaction again from the first time they saw it. But it just keeps getting diluted. And every time this stuff happens, it just keeps getting more and more diluted to the point where, like, oh, yeah, okay. I didn't like it that much. What was it to like? It's like, and that's where you get the people that, like you mentioned before, right? They want to be there just to hate it. And it's just like, how can you expect that? Anyway, I'm rambling a little too much on this, but yeah, I'm
That's
putting
all
my
right.
foot down. I'm putting my foot down on this alien Earth, and it's like I'm willing to bet it was something else, and no, they couldn't justify spending the money on it. And they're like, you know what? You put a xenomorph on there, and we can stamp alien on it and give it the green light tomorrow. So I'm never going to watch it, but if you do, just keep in the back of your mind. Does all of this work if we take the xenomorph out and we have no mention of any of that alien universe? Does the story still hold water? Because chances are, I get the feeling that you'll find all the parts are there. And you go, if this still work if you didn't have this, it's just, we need to sell some underoos. So we're going to put the xenomorph stamp on it. Call it alien. You get back to me.
Which funny is because I'm excited for it, and I'm like, I don't know that I can argue with you about it because it has all these other creatures in it, and I'm like, oh God, yeah, like you could, I absolutely can see what you're saying. So I'm
It's
still gonna
like,
watch it. So, but like, yeah, no, I get it.
and again, all these other creatures could have been things that maybe they had in mind if Prometheus had done better and they could have kept going off on that tangent. But I mean, the last movie that came out, I didn't see it, Romulus, but from what I was told by everybody that went to see it, is that basically they just remade the first movie with a younger cast. And I'm like, all right.
Well,
Okay.
see, all right, so to be fair, what they did is they made an Oreo. They took the chocolate of the first movie, the vanilla of the second movie, and added maybe some peanut butter on top with some new wrinkles, and it's kind of like
I got you.
it's a super cut. So it's a
And then they
little,
deep fried
yeah.
it.
So it's 'cause yeah, it's there's a point where you're like, oh wow, so they're doing, X, and it's you get a little from the first movie and a little from the second movie and then a little from a new movie. So,
With a younger cast.
yep, absolutely.
Because teenagers in space, that's what we're all lining up.
Well, yeah.
And again, that's the part that I don't get either, because it's like, that what made that first movie work so well was like you just had a bunch of middle-aged people working a job, man. They're just doing their job. Their job just happened to be out in in light years away from home, but they were working stiffs. That's all it was. It's like nobody was pretty. They were just working stiffs, man. They really didn't get along either. The cryo sleep was the best part, because when they were awake, they didn't want to actually have to interact. They just be so long as they could work, everything was fine. But man, this thing threw everybody off, because it was like, wait, why are we woke up now? That was the whole thing. And
Yeah.
again, it's that dynamic that when you're young, you don't understand it. If you're an adult watching it, you get it because it's like, yeah, I don't want to talk to the people I work with outside of work. Are you kidding me? God forbid that should happen. We got to take care of an emergency? Oh, are you kidding? No. Like, I want to put in my 8 hours, go back to sleep. And then spend the next 8 years getting home and then wake up and just go to my family. So, yeah. But anyway, yeah, let me know how that thing works out. If alien Earth is like, if you take the xenomorph out of it, and again, there'll be stuff attached to that, though, because you'll have the, well, I can't remember the name, Weyland-Yutani, you'll have all that, all the little cake decorations, all that stuff in there. But I mean, basically, if you took that out, would it still work on its own legs? Of just like the basic premise, from what I gathered, is going out there looking for stuff that we can weaponize bringing it back. And again, that is the twist in the very first movie, that they think that it's just like, oh, there's this distress signal, we got to go investigate it because according to a contract, we have to investigate this stuff. Only to find out later on, it's like, no, they planned this. You were supposed to go out there. They planned you going past this place. Your route back was dictated so that you went by this and caught that distress signal because they knew there was something out there. So again, but now it's to the point where somebody says, yeah, but what if they were just doing it to do it all along? Again, like going back to something like the Andromeda strain, where it's like the whole premise of that was that Scoop mission was out there looking for stuff, but it came back in the wrong spot on Earth. It came back in some little podunk town instead of landing where it was supposed to. So then it gets loose. So yeah, I just went because again, to me, that to me is what I see more and more of like, here's this cool idea and this cool script, but nobody wants to take the chance to spend the money on it to get it out there unless they can find a way to put that corporate stamp on it, that IP that they know will put the butts in the seats. You know, like, and another one I'm going to, and again, I'm going to go to toad on this, probably come back to kick me in the ass one day. I don't know. But that Joker movie, that Joaquin Phoenix Joker movie,
oh,
I thought the same way about that when I watched it. I was like, you know, this has shades of Taxi Driver and King of Comedy. And it looks like somebody wrote a script that was just trying to show like this is what happens when somebody is a little not quite playing with all the marbles and certain things get in line and this is what happens. And they said, yeah, that's like a 70s film and we don't do that anymore. But if we can stamp Joker on it and make it part of this DC extended universe, which really that means I don't know what. nothing connects at all because we're trying to copy Marvel, but not nearly as well. And it's like, so we're just going to have Joker on it. And now we know we'll put butts in seats. Because again, you know, I waited till I think it was on some streaming service or something that, like, you know, it, like a lot of the stuff I'll watch, like, well, it's already on this service. I'm already paying for this service. I already paid for it. I'm not. And it's like, and then I watched, like, you know, that wasn't bad. I just don't know why they had to call it this.
Yep. Yeah.
And then I start to do the, you know, the backwards engineering, and then I realize, oh, it's the only way it got made. If they hadn't put that stamp on it, it never would have got made because, you know, again, they can make movies like they used to. They just won't anymore because all of this stuff has gotten so big, and there's so much money riding on it. They just can't afford to take any chance. And I think that's something that's missed. And it's something that's missed getting back to comics, something that's missed in the big two. But again, the big two don't make comics anymore. They're just the host for the IP because the parent companies don't care about comics. Disney doesn't care about those Marvel comics.
Yeah.
Marvel for the past 30 years didn't care about Marvel comics. I try to tell this to my friends and family. It's like, you know, hey, don't you want to work for Marvel again? They don't make comics. They make junk mail that you pay for. they make ad pieces for their IPs and their products that you pay for. There's no story here. There's nothing going on. These characters, I don't even recognize these characters. Why would I even want to get into that sandbox and play? I don't understand how these toys work anymore. So it's like, yeah, Disney doesn't care about that. You know, Time Warner, I mean, they never cared about any of the DC comics. So, you know, it's like, no, those big two don't even care about that stuff anymore. So they're not going to try to, let's do something different. No, they will just keep stamping out the tried and true same stuff. And the reason they can do it is because there will always be artists and writers willing to do it. And, you know, and again, they don't even have to be good. Like I'm just saying, like, there will always be somebody willing to step in there and do it because to them, now they've made it. You know, and as someone that actually worked for Marvel once upon a time, and the friends that I've had that have as well, it's like, and this is something else I tell a lot of young talent too, when they're talking about doing this stuff, it's like, what is it you want out of this? Because if all you want to do is work for Marvel, or work for DC, if that's all you want to do with your life, trust me, you will. Nothing's going to stop you. Because if I could do it, I know you can do it. I did it. We were living back in primitive times, and I was able to do it. You've got an easy way. You can reach everybody in the world with everything that you're doing, so they can see that you can do it. But you got to ask yourself, what is it you really want to do? Is this all you want to do with your life, Marvel or DC? Because you may find there's more things you want to do. So you've got to really ask yourself what that thing is. But yeah, I think there's a lot of, I guess what I'm saying is, I think I would rather read somebody's alien fanfic than go watch anything that the company is putting out. Because I get the feeling I would get something a bit more inspired. You know, there is something, I don't know, am I taking up too much of your time? Should I
No,
just
you're
shut up and should I just shut up, drink my milk and go to bed?
fine.
Somebody get him his ZzzQuil. Somebody put him to bed. There's this book that I just got thanks to my sweetie, Claudine Creates. Everybody look for her. And don't hold her accountable for all the ranting and raving that I'm doing. Nothing to do with this. But I had made mention of this book that I had read, comic book. Called Afterburner by the man's name is Robert Stewart, if I remember correctly. And he's out in California. And I remember reading this thing. I read a digital copy of it because it was basically all I could afford it. Back in, I think, maybe 2020 or something like that. And he does all of it, he does all the art. I think he puts it all together too. I think he does the production of it too. Does everything but actually print the thing. And it's this group that has been put together, and they are there's really not one likable person. I mean, they're all likable because they're all charming, but like these are not people you want to really turn your back on at any given moment. And they go out there and they wind up doing the right thing sometimes, but they do try to make a little money while they're doing it. But so it's like if I were to talk to somebody who's like reading Marvel and DC, I would say, take Suicide Squad and Guardians of the Galaxy, but then put it in this mixer where you've got a lot more sex and a lot more high adventure stakes and a lot more style. Because the guy is really just does a great job working on the outfits for everybody. And I got to tell you, the names he comes up for, not just the characters, but the adventures, the jobs, the planets, everywhere they're going, I'm just like, man, I wish I would have thought of that. Wow, you know, it's really been enjoyable. So anyway, my sweetie bought like the volume that has the first three issues in it, and I think the first three issues are sold out, and issues 4, 5, and 6, and the standalone issues are like $5, you know, and it's about at least 20 pages, could even be more, but you get at least 20 pages of story, plus you get some pinups and stuff, you know, little things like that. Advertising for any merchandise and shop keys he's got going on. But Afterburner by Robert Stewart, it's really enjoyable. And it's like, to me, I read this and I'm like, I'll probably see five more Suicide Squad movies and Guardians of the Galaxy movies come out before anybody looks at this stuff and says something about it and say, why don't you turn this into something? You know, granted, you may have to tone down certain aspects if you want to get family there, but at the same time, it doesn't need to be for kids. You can make it for adults because you keep acting like you want to make stuff for adults, but you're selling toys, you know? And it's just like, so, you know, I don't know. Make up your mind what it is you want to do. But anyway, I think it's enjoyable. And if you want that, if you want a little different spin on space opera, and again, these are not deep stories he's telling. They're deep to a certain extent where it's like there's certain subject matter that he touches on, but he ain't hitting anybody over the head. He's not preaching to anybody. It's just that you realize they do come up with conundrums and they, you know, you get the it's a lot of that stuff is there just so you get a better idea of who these characters are. And now you get to see how they're going to react to things. But like I said, it's not like, you know, oh, and here's this scrappy, you know, bunch of, you know, there's nobody really, like I said, they're charming as hell. But I wouldn't want to timeshare a condo with any of these people. So it's like I said, I mean, I want them in my corner if I'm in a fight, but I would never want to get on the wrong side of these people because they would disappear me in a heartbeat. But anyway, if anybody's listening and they care about that sort of thing, Afterburner, Tales of the Cool and Wicked is the subtitle for that. Afterburner, Tales of Cool and Wicked by Robert Stewart. And you can buy his stuff online. He's on Facebook and he's on Instagram. So I should be pushing my own stuff, but you know, this is how I am. I'm, you know, I'm going to push somebody else's stuff because I really enjoy it. It's like it's one of those things. And again, stuff like that's the stuff that geeks me. That's the stuff that pumps fire into me that I say, yeah, you know what? I'm not just out here by myself. There are other people fighting the good fight, trying to get this stuff out here. So yeah, you know, let's just keep doing it. Let's just keep doing it. Like, and anytime I see someone doing something like that, you know, I'm just kind of like, yeah, let's keep this going. I mean, there's another local guy. I can't remember his name off the top of my head. All Sorrows is what you can look him up by. You look up All Sorrows, Sorrows. And he has this book, and now it's going to kill me because for the life of me now, I can't remember the title of it. It's like Peppermint. Oh, what was Peppermint. Oh, I don't even want to try to say what it could have been. But he put out this book. I mean, and he does a lot of illustration work, graphic design work, and stuff like that. And I need to look up. Really need to look up. But anyway, it's another guy that's out there doing this stuff. And Peppermint Dessert. That's what it is.
Yeah, as I said, I just looked it up. Yep, Sean Peacock.
Yes, thank you. Sean Peacock, Peppermint Dessert, All Sorrows. And I'm telling you, again, you've got this. I can't remember. I don't think they're boyfriend and girlfriend. I think they're brother and sister, Mickey and Saturday, I think are their names. And it's like if you like that kind of rockabilly feel with like some really cool colors and stuff, and they're on the run from the devil, and it's just, and again, it's a one and done book. I think it was pretty long. I think maybe 40 pages or something like that. It was more than just like a 20 page comic, like at least that was maybe about 44, 48, maybe too much, maybe 40, whatever. But it was just a rollicking good ride. It's something like, again, it's like if you like shit on Adult Swim, yeah, I could see this as an Adult Swim cartoon, you know, that would gain a fucking cult audience, you know. And again, I know he's working on another one, but if you get out there and you buy Peppermint Dessert by Sean Peacock, you won't be disappointed. It was a lot of fun. And again, done in one, it's just zany adventure. But again, but done with style. And I just, again, it's just one of those things that I really, really loved. It really kind of just made me, it made me feel good to know that it's like, I'm glad to know that this stuff is out there, because I go into a comic store and I see a wall of same crap over and over and over again. And it's just like, I like seeing something that looks a little different and reads a little different. You got like, the stuff isn't made by committee in order to fulfill a certain, need. It's like, these are just artists out there doing their own thing. And again, there's plenty of local artists I could also buy too, but I don't have it right now, and I don't have their stuff. But those are the couple, like Sean, I'm pretty sure he's Michigan-based. I could be wrong, maybe he's from Ohio or something. I usually see him at larger conventions.
I say
But
it's he's looks like he's from the region, 'cause he did art for something for the old Miami,
okay, all right.
so at least
So, and
he's
then
in the
Robert
region.
Stewart out in California, doing Afterburner, and this stuff is just, it's just a lot of fun. And that's not to say that my old peeps don't still do good things. And I think James LaBarre's got another Crow book out on the stands right now. And Vince is working on something that he hasn't been able to tell anybody about. And so he's got something coming out soon. And Guy Davis, he's been working with Guillermo del Toro for like the past decade and a half, maybe almost 2 decades now, doing production work and concept art. I don't know if he's ever going to go back to comics, but he's doing well. And most of the old Gallagher crew, I mean, everybody moved on. There's, and again, if anybody out there listening, if you go and you go to any like a Wikipedia page or anything for Gallagher, and you look at the list of people that came through those doors, and a lot of them went on to work at Marvel and DC and do all these other things as well as their own stuff. I mean, there are a lot of people that, if it wasn't for Gary Reed, not saying that they wouldn't have hit on their own because they had the drive and they had the talent. I'm just saying he gave them a big boost up, because at that time, back in the this shining moment from 1990 to, let's say, maybe 96, Caliber was like, it was like a little Camelot. It was just like, there was so many cool things going on, and that was like basically that nice little last echo boost from what started back in the 80s, and for that big explosion, with a lot of, I would just have to say, I don't even want to say alternate, but definitely not independent, because independents have been around before, but they were kind of few and far between. Very few people doing it on their own back in the 60s and the 70s. In the 80s, it really took off, thanks to Peter Laird. And I'm kind of rambling now because I'm just going on this train of thought here with all the comic stuff. But anyway, don't know. Do you have any other questions? Is there anything else you want to get me focused on before I start rambling off, going off into the trees? I'm
Well,
up
I
in
mean,
the tree line now.
I was gonna to kind of wrap us up, ask you what you were working on. So you here's your moment
Now you want to. Just teasing.
here's your moment to promote yourself.
Yes. Okay, I'll do that because my sweetie Claudine Creates, look her up. She will. She. I will hear no answer from her. She's like, you didn't talk about any of your stuff. Why didn't you talk about your stuff? I'm like, I'm sorry. It's just not how I am. I am currently working hard as I can on, I have several stories. These are things that I started, well, they started actually a few years ago as just a lark. Like, I would come up with ideas and draw out like a mock cover, and then I would post it on Instagram and Facebook, and I'd give like a little two or three sentence, elevator pitch of what the thing was. And people would say, "Oh, that sounds great. That sounds great." I said, "Hey, you know what? Give me a buck, come up with a contract, and I'll sell it to you. You can do whatever you want with it." Because at the time, I was just kind of taking a break. I was drawing still and doing illustrations and selling stuff on eBay and doing stuff like that. But the thought of doing a comic, I was kind of like, man, I don't know if I want to jump back into there. Because again, if you haven't done it, you just don't realize how much work is involved, especially if you're doing everything. So this was probably maybe 4 years ago I started, doing this stuff. And then after a while, I left where I was, and I was living on the road. I was living in my car and in motel rooms for a while, and I had a journal with me. And I started just like breaking down like the first 6 to 12 pages of a couple of these stories, the ones that really kind of like I couldn't like get them out of my head. One was called Bog Beast, and again, we had really interesting, innovative original title, Bog Beast, rather than that. But I call it Bog Beast, Shallows and Bog, and I started working on that. And then another one was Symbiote Sue. And so Bog Beast is basically, like, again, as you can't tell from the title, there's a bog monster involved. But unlike Swamp Thing or Man Thing or anything like this, it's not truly sentient, and it isn't somebody that got turned into something. It is literally the decaying bodies of people that have been murdered in this bog that have resonated and taken form. And the lead character is a retired police captain that has been writing some true crime novels and been very successful. And she's in this town investigating a story and winds up being confronted not only by a killer, but this monster, and is given the task of solving the murder mysteries of people that have been left that nobody knows are there, or maybe they do. So basically, it's about having somebody who comes from a very black and white world of, I'm investigating a crime, I think the wife did it, I'm going to find out that the wife did it. You know, it's like, only to be confronted with something that, like, I don't even know what I just saw. What did I just see? I know I saw it, I just don't know what it was I saw. There's something weird going on. Maybe things aren't as black and white as I thought. And then Symbiote Sue, which is about a doctor, a medical officer on the ship that was transferring from a ship to a space station, and winds up crash landing on this alien planetoid, or alien to Earth. But she's actually the alien, because it's, so there's these life forms living out there, and they're kind of like, they're like little, little chitinous little, critters. And they're having a civil war. She basically crash lands in the middle of this thing. She's all burned up and her body's all spilling out and everything because of a bad crash. And some of the survivors of that, from the crash land, this war, so they go down there and they try to help her. And again, it's only because they've got, like, their leaders have got some sort of like telepathic communication, because they communicate, they're basically like a bunch of big bugs and stuff, insect-looking things, creepy crawly things. But they're basically compatible enough with her, and the leader is able to communicate with her, but she doesn't realize what's happening. And they kind of basically put her back together using themselves. So they all take on a symbiotic thing, a whole bunch of them get together and become her legs and internal organs and stuff. And so she's basically fused, they're fused with her and she's fused with them. And then she now has to try to get rescued, but then try to figure out why she even crash landed in the first place, because she doesn't understand why. Like, her memory's kind of not clear anymore. So then it's about her getting rescued and then finding out that maybe everything that she thinks is going on, again, it's like, maybe there's something else going on here, you know, because they're kind of treating you a little different, but they're not treating you as different as they should be treating you. Meanwhile, you've got this voice in your head that's telling you things. And again, it, to me, the story is, how do you know you're on the right side of the fight? You know, maybe you're trying to do the right thing, but how do you know you haven't been compromised? And then another one is Sleigh Bell, which is basically just a throwback. That's going to be like the easiest one to do, because the story is basically like, you like 80s horror slashers, right? Me too. So we're going to do this one. Takes place on the holiday. Guess which holiday? It's called Sleigh Bell. Guess which holiday we could possibly be doing that all this bloodletting on. And so it's about a gal that on her 18th birthday, and her birthday is on Christmas Eve because 18 years ago, her mother gave birth to her after a terrible car accident. Her mother didn't survive. And there's a big family secret going on, and her grandfather is killed on her 18th birthday, and she freaks out, and she's sequestered away, and for 3 years she's in an asylum, and finally, one of her cousins, who's like the same age as her, who has been going to law school and stuff, he basically gets power of attorney and tries to get her out of it and bring her back, and then she's like, okay, I'll come with you, but we're going to have Christmas at the house, at the big home, and I want everybody there, everybody that was there 3 years ago. And so all the relatives have to come back. And then hijinks ensue. So those three. And then I just did the one thing that I put out. I put out an ash can of Bog Beast and Symbiote Sue, like little, like the first few pages of each of those. So it's like about maybe 28 pages altogether. Like half of it's Bog Beast and part of it's Symbiote Sue. So you get a little smattering of what's going on with those. I think there might be another ash can up on Etsy right now. We have an Etsy store, which is 6368 Studios. Claudine commandeers that. Ghost of the Ripper is the first in a series of these things. When I get more stories, then I'll be putting out a little anthology of it. And it's just, this is the one that I put in the ash can is about the lost film. So it's about this lost 70s film called Ghost of the River, where it's found out that the effects artist on it, they had to can all prints of the movie because it came out that he was actually killing transients in order to better his special effects, you know, to get a good idea of what something really looks like. And so, again, there's an old horror movie host and a watch party, and hijinks ensue when the ghost of the river is let loose again. And so that's like its own little complete short story. And then I have another little short story that I had done that I got to back that up with. So you got about another 28, 32 pages worth of stuff in that ash can. And I'll be doing more Ghost of the River stories. And the way I see the whole Ghost of the River book is when it's totally complete will be just an anthology of different types of river stories. They can take place at any time period. They can take place modern day. They can take place back in Whitechapel in 1888. But just that's the only theme that has to stay true to. It's just it has to be like river like. So I've got that. And so out of all these things, I'm working on all these at the same time. So I'm kind of like hopscotching around, you know, like I'll rough out maybe 6 to 10 pages of Bog Beast, but I've already gotten that amount done on Sleigh Bell. So I'll go over to Sleigh Bell and I'll start penciling those pages out. Then I'll go back over to Bog Beast, pencil out the pages I roughed out. Then go back over to Sleigh Bell and start inking those. So I'm going back and forth and then lettering here and there, going back and forth, kind of bopping around with all these ideas that I'm trying to get down. I know I should probably just focus on one and try to get that one done, at least like 28, 30 pages and just put something out there. But I want to kind of bounce around on these so I can get enough of each of these done that I can at least feel confident that I can put, either one big book together or be able to rapid fire get like Blog Beast out there. And then as people are just digesting that, get Sleigh Bell out there and then Sun Yat-Tzu and then some more Ghost of the River. But at this point right now, I think there's one Ghost of the Ripper ash can left up on the Etsy store. I just got stapled together six more of the Bog Beast one that are first printings because the rest of the first printings sold out at the past, well, there was a convention back in April in Dearborn, and just about everything we brought there flew off the tables. And we put a half a dozen of each on the Etsy store, and those just this past week, have, now the last one of those, with the exception of one Ghost of the River, are gone. So that's the stuff I'm working on now. So this is all my own stuff, my own artwork. I'm doing the writing. And again, like, because so I'm older, so you would think I wouldn't have the energy to do it, but, and I don't, but I really have nothing else to do. So I'm writing all of these. I'm doing all the artwork, lettering them. When it comes time to actually putting some bigger sized books together, we'll be finding a printer next week. Right now, we're just doing some little ash cans just to get some people to take notice and get, everybody, give everybody a little taste of it. So, we can wet the whistles and hopefully get some fans eager so that when I'm done, it can be out there. And yeah, so that's what I'm doing. So we've got like four titles now that I'm working on instead of just sticking with just one thing. I'm gonna try to do all four and try to keep working on them every day and get more and more done so that hopefully within the next couple of months I can put another round of stuff out there. And for anybody that may be listening to this, because I don't know who's going to be listening to your show, but maybe somebody that remembers Night Streets from back in the day. Usually we'll get people that say, God, I wish you would do some more Night Streets. Well, you never know. That may happen. But I'm doing this stuff right now. So if you want to see more Night Streets, you got to help support this stuff. And that may just dovetail in more. So, but anyway, that's what I'm doing right now. Chris, I'm taking on more than I should, and I'm going to do nothing but probably be drawing every spare chance I get, and still taking on commissions because again, these stories don't pay anything until something starts really selling. So I do take on commissions and do artwork, and a lot of that's been sketch cards lately. But I still every once in a while get commissions to do some bigger illustrations, and that helps pay the bills. So that's about it. That's what's going on with me.
Fantastic. Now, how can folks track you down and follow you online and everything?
I'm on Facebook. Again, just type in Mark Bloodworth, and they'll see me. I'm on Facebook, I'm on Instagram. I think there's probably an old Tumblr out there somewhere, but I never do anything with that anymore. So basically, Facebook, Instagram, the 6368 Studios on Etsy. I've got some original art up there that I'm selling, and Claudine has some stuff up there, and we've got t-shirts that I've done. And again, like I said, the ash cans will be up there as well. So, Facebook, and I'm actually, I don't know, what am I on Facebook? I don't even know if I remember what I am on Facebook. That's the thing, is like you get asked this stuff, and I'm like, well, I mean, I think I'm actually, maybe I'm actually some sort of thing on Facebook, but I can't remember what it is. I have a Linktree too, like, so you can find Linktree. And then there's Linktree links on all the other stuff. I do have a Patreon as well. I forgot about that. I do have a Patreon, which I need to get back out there and update some stuff. So I have a Patreon, and I'm just Mark Bloodworth on there. And my Facebook is, what am I?
Mark.
What's the one just before?
Bloodworth.92.
There you go. But again, if you just do a search and look for Mark Bloodworth, you'll see my ugly red-headed mug. The red's fading a little bit. There's lots of Mark Bloodworths out there. There's a lot more than when I was growing up, but you'll see, because there'll be a bunch of art on there. There'll be my really cute little sweetie Claudine, and you'll look at my friends and you'll say, "Oh, this is Vince," and then all these other people he talked about. So this has got to be him. And same thing with Instagram. I'm probably the same. Same thing, or probably it could just be, it might be Bloodworth 1963 on Instagram, I'm thinking. Anyway, if you look up Mark Bloodworth, Bloodworth 1963, somewhere on the social medias you'll find me. So I am out there. But I don't know how you do it with your podcast. Like, you put a little blurb and you just copy and paste everybody's links in there so when people come, they get it. I don't know how you do that, but feel free to do that. But yeah, so on Instagram, I think I am. I think I'm like Mark Levin.
All right, perfect. Well, I can't thank you enough for making time for me. This has been fantastic. This has been absolutely great. So thank you very much.
Oh, well, I appreciate the interest, man. I appreciate the fact that you remember me, and always like talking to you and like seeing you. And I know that you're out there in Flint trying to keep, fan the flames of horror and do all that kind of stuff, which isn't easy.
Certainly trying.
Well, thank you very much. I'm glad to have been on, and thanks for spending so much time with me and indulging this rambling old
You're very
man.
welcome. Thank you so much. You take care.
Okay, you too. Bye-bye.
Bye. I once more want to thank Mark Bloodworth for making some time to speak to me. That was an amazing conversation about his work in comics and how he got into horror and movies and all kinds of great stuff, and just a really, really cool conversation. As he'd mentioned, you can find him on Facebook, and that has links to his other profiles, and you can find him on Instagram and on Etsy as well. So I can't thank him enough. As always, you can find all my podcasts, reviews, and everything else at spookychris.com, and I will speak to you soon.